I'm Mr. Fix-It.
And I'm Diablo Frank.
We're going to cuss and spoil stuff.
June 3rd, 1992.
Mad Magazine's publisher Bill Gaines was dead at 70.
Lethal Weapon 3 topped the box office.
Jump by Criss Cross was the number one jam.
The TV show Raven, about a ninja-trained former Special Forces agent battling the Black Dragon Clan to save his long-lost son with the help of Lee Majors, was about to debut on CBS.
But before that, Spawn happened.
I want you to be the host, so I
I still I can't do it. Let me grow into it. Much like Spawn, I have to deny
You've
it in the beginning.
You've been doing this for too long, man. You can
I have
do
to
this.
Deny it in the beginning, and then you're Malvolgia, and you made a deal with me, and I'm like, fuck it. And then I'm going to turn white, which I don't know, in this climate would be actually a plus. I wouldn't really complain. So this is Spawn talk on the bed.
When you meaning to Spawn with the shit.
Welcome to Spawn talk.
It's not Spawn talk.
Okay, so me and Frank here are going to discuss.
Well, what's the show called?
Spawnometer?
Yeah, the Spawnometer.
Okay.
You remember, what is the Spawnometer?
I like Spawn talk better.
No, what is the Spawnometer?
Okay, so if you read the Spawn comics of the 90s, he had a clock that was ticking down his mortality or
his
power?
Energy level. The more power he used, the quicker his clock ran down, and when his clock got to zero, he was supposed to die.
Okay, so his mortality clock then.
Well, no, but it's not determined by how much life he has. It's determined by how much energy he uses.
Okay,
so he's got 9999 at the start of his clock when he first becomes Spawn.
Okay,
and the more power he exerts, if he does something really big, then his clock's going to run down faster. If he parses it out better, he can live for an indeterminate period of time, but potentially quite a while.
Okay, so this is one of Frank's experiments. I feel like a guinea pig. We're going to talk about 90s comic books.
Specifically, we're going to talk about Todd McFarlane's Spawn and other Image comics.
And branch out to Savage Dragon and other Image books that Spawn may have touched upon in his long and sad career so far, from what I've
heard. I don't know about sad, but definitely sorted.
Sorted. Okay, I'll go with sorted. Each episode will be only as long as the issue we've read, and we read issue one.
If it's a 22-page comic, then we've got 22 minutes to get it done.
God, that's a lot of time to fill in.
Potentially, yeah.
Because that's a pretty thinly veiled book we read. And we've actually watched the first episode of Spawn that came out on HBO in, I'd say, the late 90s?
Late 90s, early 2000s, yeah.
Okay. We can use that as filler, because trust me, one issue, 22 minutes, whew, that's definitely a challenge. I think we've got a fair amount to talk about.
That's
for Hercules there.
Yeah, I think we got a fair amount to cover the first maybe two issues, and then it's going to get more tricky to fill out 22 minutes. Now, it doesn't have to take 22 minutes, but we have to get done within 22 minutes.
Okay.
We can choose to conserve our power so that our podcasts live longer.
Well, we're already at 2 minutes, for Christ's sake, and I already feel like we've already finished the book. Like, we've literally discussed what the book's about.
Well, what happens in issue number one of Spawn?
Okay, well, let's do a little backdrop. McFarlane leaves Marvel, starts his own company.
With six other major creators from Marvel, yeah.
Spawn was the first book to come out, was it? No, Youngbloods was.
Yeah, yeah.
Youngbloods came out and just destroyed. I remember, and that's for Matt, because he says that so fucking often. Destroyed. It came out. I remember everyone bought issues of it. Everybody wanted on it. I remember thinking, damn, it's just the Avengers, but okay. And then...
Actually, it was the the Teen Titans.
Teen Titans?
Rob Liefeld was part of a Teen Titans mailing list. You know, because back before the internet, they would actually have like little newsletters and stuff, and they'd build it off of fan content. And so Liefeld had managed to parlay that into talks with DC Comics, especially around the time he was doing the Hawk and Dove miniseries. And so he was going to do a spinoff about Titans West. And so Shaft was Speedy slash Arsenal.
Oh, okay.
Vogue was Harlequin slash Joker's daughter. One of them was going to be a Kund. Die Hard was going to be a robot from Star Labs.
They
all kind of lined up. I don't remember who all was going to be part of that, but that's what that came out of, was that Titans proposal.
Okay.
And my understanding is they could never make the numbers add up right. They got serious about doing it after Liefeld was already at Marvel. So it was a matter of DC trying to pull a burn on Superman and pull Liefeld away from Marvel to DC. And Marvel was just going to pay more than DC ever was going to. And that's why X-Force ended up happening instead.
Okay. Because I always felt that X-Force, I guess you could say, was the granddaddy of Young Bloods. It felt that way.
Well, I mean, X-Force is selling, what was it, like 5 million copies, I think it was? Because the way it worked is McFarlane was the first comic book creator in ages, at least since Man of Steel, but probably before that, because I don't remember what Man of Steel's numbers were. McFarlane sold 2 million copies of Spider-Man number one based on the different color variations on the cover.
Yeah, I remember that.
Marvel stole that idea from Legends of the Dark Knight number one, where they did the different colored outer covers, which was super lame. So then Liefeld beats that by having the bound-in trading cards. They're polybagged with different trading cards, 5 different ones, I think it was. And so X-Force, I think, did something along the lines of 4 to 5 million copies. And then X-Men number one came out, and they did 5 different covers, including the glossy stock, extra length, pinup laden E cover, and did like 7 or 8 million copies. And so one of the things that made Image such a big deal is all these guys, right after they have these record sales, goes, hey, we're going to go form our own comic book company instead. And that's why Image was such a huge deal. And because people had left the majors to go do their little niche books, boutique books prior to that. But for all the biggest artists to go and leave Marvel at the same time, most of them instigated by Todd McFarlane. He was the most militant about, hey, let's go do our own thing, that made Image happen.
And if you want some better stories about this, Frank has a recording with Peter David. Didn't you do one with him?
Yeah, but let's not drag.
Oh, that was fantastic.
Mac alerted Eric Larson to that, and Eric Larson was like, that fucker's still talking about Image after all these years.
That's right, kids. Other sites just talk. We start battles. We are the rap battles of comic books. Anyway, so.
But how did you come to Todd McFarlane too? Because, I mean, did you buy Spawn number one when it came out?
Actually, dude, I remember him when he drew an issue of the What Ifs, the Fantastic Four, the four different. Wait, did he? Okay, so he did. I remember Jim Lee did a What If for Inferno Wolverine Ate a Baby. I believe McFarlane did one.
I thought Ron Lim did that one.
No, that's Jim Lee.
Ron, the one where he was Inferno. What if the demons had conquered during Inferno?
It's Jim
and
Lee.
He kills Kitty Pryde at the end.
Yeah.
That was Ron Lim, dude.
I thought that was Ron Lim, man.
Because that was my favorite What If. When I read that, I remember, I think I was locked out of my house or something. We were living at in a rent house. And so I'm sitting on the steps reading.
Frank story. Here we go.
Yeah, and I'm reading, I think it was What If number 6. And they make Wolverine, who's a demon-possessed version of Wolverine, kill Kitty Pryde. And I was like, oh, no, not Kitty. And then I think Wolverine's skeleton comes alive and stabs Baron Mordo. And I just went, yeah!
No.
That is so cool.
That one, I just remember that they reward him. We're giving him an infant. And that you just see a picture.
Yeah, I think he eats a baby or something. Yeah, that was messed up. But I loved that What If as a kid.
There's that one. I could have sworn McFarlane did one where it was.
I don't remember McFarlane ever doing a What If.
Four all had the same powers. Four stories where they all had the same powers. So they're all invisible. They're all rock. They're all fire. I want to say that was one.
Okay.
I was also introduced to his artwork in his Batman covers.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because he did year two. He took over after Alan Davis left to go do Excalibur.
So I remember those covers from him.
You're right. That was my first exposure to McFarlane, too, because I think the third part of Batman Year 2, because I thought the cover looked cool, is the one where Batman had the gun and he's pointing it. I bought that at a B. Dalton bookseller. So, yeah, I thought that my first exposure with McFarlane was the Invasion crossover, which I flipped that at Safeway, but never was willing to buy it because it was $3. That was way too much to ask for a comic book.
Yeah.
It was full of dumbass DC Silver Age aliens. I didn't give a crap about that. But, yeah, you're right. It was Batman Year 2 when I was first exposed to it.
That's where I was first, because I remember looking at it. I remember asking, dude, who's this artist? Like, I really like this art.
Yeah.
And the guy said, like, oh, it's McFarlane, da da da. And I'm like, okay, don't know who the hell that is, okay. Mm-hmm. But he knew who he was. So that was my first introduction to him. And then.
Well, he packed so much detail, like so many lines.
Yeah.
You know?
It had a cartoony feel, but it was fresh. I remember at the time, to me, Art Adams was the top.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
If Art Adams drew a dildo with a donut, I would buy that artwork just because I wanted to own it. And McFarlane came in really close with the art style that I liked it enough that I picked it up.
Yeah. Well, and he looked a lot like Michael Golden, I think, too.
Oh, yeah, Michael Golden.
He kind of like was cross of Art Adams and Michael Golden.
Yeah, I would give you that. Yes. So
it's Mike Ploog, too, I think. Remember we were liking Mike Ploog on Werewolf by Night and Ghost Rider?
So, okay, so he's up there in the enchilant of artists that have this cartoony yet realistic look that is very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very pleasing to the eye compared to a lot of the artists around them that were very basic line structure. They didn't put a lot of detail. They, I guess you would say, they almost relied more on color and other things. So I enjoyed his art style. I remember seeing the Spider-Man because everyone bought Spider-Man because of that, because of the webbing. I remember he made a big joke about how he did the webbing and then regretted it later because he would have to do that every time.
Yeah,
because it was so time consuming.
Yeah.
So I was on.
That's just it because I remember when I was still reading Spider-Man at the time when McFarlane was coming in, and it seemed like everybody they had doing Spider-Man books was very Bronze Age and kind of journeyman. Like Sal Buscema was doing one, I think. I think Ron Frenz was doing one. I think Alex Saviuk was doing one. And so then you get this McFarlane dude coming in, and he looked nothing like those other guys.
Well, his anatomy,
packing in all that incredible detail. And see, Art Adams, as much as I loved him, he could never produce on any kind of a schedule. I remember my brother was buying Longshot as it came out, and there would just be these huge gaps between issues. Yeah. You're like, did Longshot finish it? Are we going to have any more? And it would finally drop an issue. But everybody bought the X-Men annuals when Art Adams drew it, and there was an event. He would only put out like one or two of those annuals per year, but everybody bought it because Art Adams drew it. And then McFarlane was able to do a style, while I don't think it was nearly as good as Art Adams, but he had a level of detail somewhat comparable to him, and he was getting that out on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
So I know that blew a lot of people away.
Well, no, I remember when I would look at the Spider-Man stuff, the anatomy was really weird. Spider-Man's anatomy looked really strange, and the poses he would put was almost rubbery, but I remember thinking, well, that kind of shows that he's not almost human. He's superhuman in the fact that maybe his body doesn't bend like our body. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. So I picked up that stuff.
Well, he had this awkward arachnoid quality, which he hadn't had since Ditko, and I would say.
And it almost seemed like his joints were more swollen, or almost like, you know, the joints of a spider.
Uh-huh.
I remember thinking that was really strange. I became a fan, followed his stuff. I don't think he wrote anything, did he? Or did they do?
No, what happened was, I was like you, I would see the images on the newsstand that, you know, those covers and put through the books. I only ever bought one McFarlane drawn issue. It was an Amazing Spider-Man. There was an Inferno crossover because I was picking those up at the time. It looked fantastic. I was like, wow, this art is really, really involved. But it was still a little too cartoony for me, and I was starting to get out of Spider-Man at that point, and so I didn't buy anything else of his. But then he wanted to write his own book, and they didn't want to have to fire David Michelinie from Amazing Spider-Man so that McFarlane could draw his own book. So they gave him his own title, Spider-Man, no adjective, number one, which he wrote and drew for 16 issues.
Yeah, I remember he fought Wendigo at one time with Wolverine.
The first five-issue arc was a pseudo-sequel to Kraven's Last Hunt involving some voodoo chick, and those were terrible. My brother was buying it, and I was reading it. I was like, this sucks. Yeah. I hated those. But then they did the two-parter with Ghost Rider and some kid who had half a melted face. I think Hobgoblin was in that one, and I remember digging that one. And then he did the five-parter with Wolverine and the Wendigo. We like that one too. And then I think the last issue was a crossover with X-Force number 4 where they drew each other's characters and they both did sideways issues, and that was McFarlane's departure from Marvel.
I vaguely remember that one. I kind of remember
it wasn't any good. It wasn't very good. That was the only one I personally bought because I was buying X-Force because I was a big Liefeld fan at the time. Yeah. So I went ahead and plucked down for that. I thought that McFarlane's X-Force sucked. He was so off model and so cartoony. I hated it.
Okay, so we've already killed 13 minutes just building up
and
to
I can already see, too, we'll have to, like, carry some of this over into the next episode, too. Go ahead and give a synopsis of the issue before we run out of time.
So, well, real quick. So, went, bought my first issue at a comic shop. They would only allow you 2 issues per customer because they were like, ooh, it's going to be like the Superman number one. These will be millions. So, well, let's go ahead and get started with the story. In the comic, you're introduced to Spawn, who is being born in an alleyway, and he's pissed because he's coming back because he wants to see Wanda.
Well, at first, he doesn't know who the wife's name. He's like, he's seeing in his mind, but he doesn't know who she is.
That's right. He sees her name. He knows there's someone he loves. There's someone he hates. There's someone he wants revenge against, but he can't. He's having all these flashbacks because, again, he's just been born. So very Benjamin Button backwards. He's an adult, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he was a grown-ass man in a funny costume, but he didn't have any memories.
And
he only had like vague recollections of what had happened. happened, who he was, what was going on.
So basically, it's Spawn being born on a chessboard and not realizing his position on the board yet. Because there's all these pieces around him already being moved in different areas, and he has no idea what's going on. But he has these vague remembrances of people and events. We're then introduced to Wanda, who's opening, I believe, half the book is just him whining and crying about finding out who he is. We get introduced to
I don't think they ever actually tell you who Wanda is in the first issue. What, there's some news. They do that. What did you call it?
Oh, the
news
ripoff. People? Yeah, the Frank Miller ripoff, where he stole the concept of having these news reporters with their dialogue bubbles underneath them, exactly like the Dark Knight Returns. I remember the first time I saw it, I'm like, yeah, that's Frank Miller right off the bat.
Yeah, so that's where they give you a ton of exposition. They mention Wanda Blake in there, but you don't know.
Bunch of mob bosses or mob hitmen are killed.
Mm-hmm. Their hearts are ripped out and shoved down their throats. And that's who Sam and Twitch. Who are Sam and Twitch, by the way?
They're supposed to be the detectives that pop up in his book. I'm trying to. I know they're based on someone.
Well, I think that Sam is Harvey Bullock from Batman.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's the overweight, slovenly police investigator
in the gray area of
morality. Yeah, loves his donuts and stuff. And then Twitch is Michael Jeter from Evening Shade and 12 Monkeys and a bunch of other movies. Oh no, Fisher King.
Fisher King.
Yeah,
I
remember the gay guy from the Fisher King.
No,
with the mustache, and he's
I actually thought he was like an Alfred character, kind of.
There's a little bit of Alfred.
Because he seems to cater to.
His personality is more like the gal who ran around with Peppermint Patty and Peanuts.
Yeah.
You know, sir? You know, he says sir, but it's always in a condescending manner.
Is he kind of like a fat Batman and this is his manservant?
You're right, though. It is kind of like Alfred, though, where he's always got this droll humor that's very dry, where he's seemingly respectful, but Sam is always like, quit the comedy, quit the bullshit. So you figure he probably has a really dry delivery.
So that's.
But he is kind of like Alfred if Alfred were played by Michael Jeter.
Yes. No, that's a good point. We're introduced to them because, again, we watched the first episode of HBO and read the comic at the same time.
Which I knew was going to be a bad idea.
No. Well, actually, no, because the comic, you feel that this is McFarlane being censored, self-censoring himself.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that he wants to make sure that the book isn't going to be adult fare because he wants to sell 1.7 million copies like he did with this issue. It's still the number one best-selling independent comic of all time, to my knowledge.
Even though he does have a almost rape scene in the book.
Yeah, but I thought that was interesting, though. Tell him about that.
So Spawn seems to be kind of just hanging out in this one part of town.
He hangs out in alleyways. Yeah,
crime alley, I guess you would say.
That's Batman.
There's a lot. Does Spawn not look like
the
Batman?
The playset was Spawn Alley.
Yeah.
Trademarks are important.
Well, okay. Very Batman-ish alley. And you have this crime where these guys, really kind of creepy, they're going to start out raping and then decide, no, we just want to cut pieces off of her. And Spawn appears. And the weird part was to me, okay, he kind of looks like a hero, but he's born of hell. So he decides to stop a rape. Which
we don't necessarily know that yet, though.
Well, no. You look at him, dude. I mean,
he doesn't look
changed.
Like he's from heaven. That's
dude, when you have a skull belt buckle over your crotch.
That's totally the Frank Castle Punisher skull, isn't it?
Yeah,
they just take out the lower jaw and the little like excess of cheekbones. That's the Punisher skull.
But that's not a character that's going to say stop. He's going to punish you.
Yeah.
He's going to hurt you. So he commences to beat up the criminals. And even there's one big guy that's like, oh, you fucked up. And he's like, he literally tells the guy, you're out of your league.
Well, he only really beats up one of the guys. And the other guys are like, we're going to take you down. And then he creates one of those boom boom bubbles. Remember Boom Boom from X Factor? Yeah. Oh, no, she was a member of X Force. Too,
yeah,
where she can create the little time bombs, the energy time bombs. So he basically makes one of those, it blows up, and it scares the other attempted rapists away.
Okay, I thought he killed the guy. So I'm
did he kill those guys?
I thought
no,
he did.
See, they're running away.
No, I assumed that he popped his fingers and
see, here's his little green boom boom bubble. Then it goes boom, and then they go running away.
Okay, well, he walks up, and the chick's like, I'll do anything you want,
don't hurt me.
Yeah,
she's scared of him as she was of the other guy.
And then he goes back into his fucking emo crying, no. No, he's freaking out, and he's seeing images of Wanda, and you know
who he still doesn't know is Wanda.
You know what? I'm starting to realize Spawn is very emo.
Oh yeah,
I'm hearing a lot of
proto emo.
Yeah, a lot of Morrissey going on in his head. Soundtrack.
Never realized how much he had in common with Red Tornado.
Of course,
by the way, that is like total George Perez wannabe layout there, is
really?
It not? Come on, that looks so much like a George Perez layout.
Yeah. Dude, McFarlane, if you're going to steal from the best.
Oh, yeah, true that.
You know, he's having flashbacks, and all of a sudden the rape victim is like...
Well, and it's important, too. He's seeing the woman that's haunting his visions at the grave, and he sees a grave with an American flag on it, and he keeps seeing patriotic motifs with guns firing over that. So you get a sense of him being tied to the military or something.
Okay, and then, of course, the...
But what I loved is he's having this creepy flashback, and he's all screaming, and he collapses, and at the end of it, the rape
victim
is comforting. interpreting him. Yeah. I always thought that was so weird, but so cool. You never saw a hero in that situation before. And I remember reading the book the first time when it came out, thinking, that's different. I respected that play.
Well, then, of course, we have some more news, and they're telling us more that's going on in the background. And
bullshit exposition.
Yeah, Spawn is walking, and all the clock's down to 9995.
So we know his boom boom bomb is worth one of the 1/5, a half of the last digit on the Spawnometer.
So is it 9 years?
No. It's just an energy counter. It's like like an odometer, but counting in reverse.
But they always have these damn clocks right next to it. So you're assuming it's time.
What clock?
Yeah, the sun.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's letting you know that he's counting down to something.
Because honestly, I always assumed that it was time-based.
Nah, it's energy-based.
I never knew it was dude, when I read the damn book, I thought it was time-based. You know,
that's an interesting point, though. I've read 4 issues before we started this show. They've not yet to reveal what the Spawnometer actually represents.
Really?
I think I knew that going in because of interviews, which was a major problem with the Image comics, is they'd tell you what was going on in the interviews, but then you would read the book, and they wouldn't tell you what the hell's going on in the actual books.
Yeah.
It makes sense you might have come to that conclusion, because I read an interview, maybe you didn't read it.
No.
And that's why you're not thinking about that.
I just remember thinking it was time, so I always thought that's such a cool idea where the book's going to end.
How much time do we have, by the way?
We're at 21 minutes and 30 seconds.
Okay, we better finish the issue. Spawn does take off his mask, and he realizes that he's all burnt up.
He's corpsified.
Corpse underneath, yeah.
He's corpsified, and he's like, no. And then, of course, at the very end, we have Sam and Twitch are now talking about all these cases that are going on in Crime Alley. And that's it. The book ends. Oh, and it's Malbolgia.
Who's not identified yet. He's just some generic devil dude.
Yeah, is at the end laughing, telling him, if you think your life's shit now. Well, he doesn't say it that way. He says, if you think your life's rough now, wait till what?
I promise your troubles have only just begun. Ha 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 ha.
Okay, so
next issue, The Violator.
So that's the comic. We're in the cartoon was way different. I'm assuming we kind of discussed, it seemed like the first 4 issues were already in the first episode of the cartoon.
Something like that, yeah.
And there's nudity and there's Tony Twist. And
well, we'll get to the cartoon when we get to the cartoon.
Okay.
We had to deal with the first issue of Spawn. We've got 30 seconds left. Would you like to say anything else in that time period before we run out?
That's 22 minutes of my life I'll never get back.
So you didn't like the issue?
Nah, dude, it's super weak. I mean, I get it. I get it's an introduction issue, but it's super weak. I don't know. I need to kind of digest it a little bit more. I mean, it's not horrible.
You got time to digest it because we are out of time. We'll talk about that in the next episode of The Spawnometer.
Yay.
What the hell is that?
I'm a legal machine.
You read a few issues of Youngblood, right?
Yep.
Just to see what the fuss was about?
Yeah. I think I bought the first 3 or 4 issues just because everybody else was buying it. So I felt like I should buy one too. And it did look good. I thought it looked really cool. I thought all the character designs were really good. I mean, obviously there were some, obvious influences on some of the characters. But I think for the most part, I thought the team looked pretty cool. So yeah, I with millions of other people, picked those first few issues.
Did you read Youngblood number 1 when it came out?
I believe I bought it, but I don't remember if I read it.
Yeah, so it was another one. How long did you buy it for?
Oh, man. I remember buying it. I think at the shop I was going to at the time, he ordered one for everyone, like it or not. Like, we all got one.
So you had, but you could choose not to buy it, I would think, right?
I don't remember having a choice.
He literally, you're going to buy this whether you like it or not.
I'm sure he probably had some kind of deal with distributor or something like that, because I remember everyone got one copy. And,
okay, because it's interesting, because I actually, if I remember correctly, the book was sold out before it even got to the distributor. And I think they actually ran a second printing of the book before the book even came out to, help fill out the orders, especially the reorders that came afterwards. And so I think the same day that the first issue came out, they came out with the second printing, which had this thick gold ink border around it, and the words second printing on the bottom right-hand corner the same fucking day the first issue came out. So did you see that second printing?
Okay. I'm trying to remember.
But it's just funny to me because, here's a book that they went into a second printing on before it had even come out, and your shop's, getting a copy for every single customer at the damn shop. Well,
it wasn't a big shop.
Okay.
It was a small shop. I think what it was is he had to order a shitload or something.
Oh, in order to guarantee he was going to get them?
Yeah, and so he didn't force
you. So were you in Texas by the time it came out?
Yeah.
Okay.
He didn't, I don't remember being forced, but I remember the issue being pushed on me. Because they were like, oh, you got to have this. It's the #1 issue. It's Image. And I'm like, I don't know who this is. I don't know anything about this. I knew about McFarlane, and I knew about Larson. Like I said, Layfield didn't really, I didn't follow him that much, but I picked it up because it was the first issue. But I remember, I don't think I got the second print. I think I got the first, I still have it somewhere in my collection of Image books.
I think I got $6 for my copy of Youngblood number one. Wised up on Image quick and sold them while they were still semi-hot. So I think I actually turned a profit off of Youngblood. I think I did the same thing with the New Mutants issues. I think I managed to turn a profit off those New Mutants issues as well, ultimately.
Because I think what I ended up doing was...
I think I got trade value. I think I was trading with the flea market booth, and I traded my New Mutants collection as I started to burn out on Liefeld and get a bunch of comics for it.
Because I just remember that was right at the... Okay, so one came out. It took a long time for two to come out, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we can discuss this.
A friend of mine called me up and said, hey, there's this big convention in San Francisco. I read about it in one of these trade magazines.
Comic book convention.
Comic book convention. Mm-hmm. And I've been to a couple of those locally, but this one had tons of editors at it on the guest list. And I had already learned that, you know, that's how you get your job, from the editors. So we got there bright and early, and I decided I'd go to hit all the small companies first. I had about 10 pages of comic book art featuring my own characters. Actually, the reason I featured my own characters was because that, you know, I was scared that I wasn't going to draw the Hulk as good as this guy did, or I'd draw Spider-Man as cool as this guy did. So I said, if it's my characters, nobody's drawing them as good as I am right now, because no one knows they exist. They were all pretty responsive.
Rob Liefeld's first published work was a pinup in the June 1986 cover dated Megaton number 5. He was still in high school at the time, and his style most resembled George Perez with a lot of other Bronze Age influences. His Super Team Young Blood debuted in the June 1987 giveaway reference book Megaton Comics Explosion, which featured characters created by Gary Carlson in a format similar to the official handbook to the Marvel Universe. The intention was to introduce readers to Liefeld's creator-owned team there before spinning them off into their own series, but sales weren't there to support any of the books in the small press's line. A house ad was reduced for Youngblood's ultimately unpublished story debut in Megaton Special No. 1 with the tagline, Titans, Legion, X-Men, No Way, Youngblood by Rob Liefeld and Hank Cannells.
So who's the chick riding the water?
Wasn't it one called Riptide?
The ad featured the characters who would become Riptide, a white woman who controlled water, or albino Mira.
Is that Riptide from Savage Dragon?
No, you're thinking of Rapture. Rapture is the black chick with the electrical powers.
Why did I think Riptide was in
Because
Savage
they had the same
too.
Lack of a costume. They both wear like a one-piece monochromatic outfit, and
like
they both had gloves. Yeah, a bathing suit, one piece bathing suit with gloves and boots, and they both have long hair. But Rapture is a black chick with black hair and energy powers, electrical energy, and she's a white chick with white hair and water powers.
Okay, right, it's coming back to me now. Wasn't there like a dude with green hair or some shit? Or no, what am I thinking of? Okay, no, you keep talking English, and I'll continue stammering in the background. Keep
okay.
On.
Sonic, spelled with a K, was flying African American woman with a blonde flat top who wore a bullet-shaped helmet. Sentinel, an African-American man in power armor similar to Iron Man's. Brahma, a large, blonde, Caucasian strong man not dissimilar from continuity's Megalith. Sci-Fire, a brown-haired male telepath, telekinetic, pyrokinetic. Cougar, a feral African-American-ish half-cat, half-human who bore a striking resemblance to the Legion of Superheroes member Timberwolf.
Yeah, I noticed one of your characters in here. I get a very Norrin Rad Silver Surfer vibe off this one guy, yeah.
And Photon, a flaming, flying alien male with energy powers. When the comic was solicited, the black and white boom had turned into a glut. Pre-orders for Megaton Special No. 1 were only 1,000 copies, and printers of the time requested a minimum of 5,000 copies be produced. There was also a centerfold pinup image produced around that time that was inked by Jerry Ordway, featuring the additional team to be called Brigade, consisting of Thermal, a blonde woman with heat powers, Cold Snap, who was basically Iceman with black hair, his brother Seahawk, or Aquaman with a gun, Alice, who was essentially the Legionnaire Colossal Boy, Stasis, a white woman who controlled kinetic energy, and KO, aka What If Puck Was From Japan Instead of Canada. The image was eventually published in 1993's Megaton Holiday Special No. 1.
And about midday, I went over to DC Comics And I said, well, I'll try and hit them up. Dick Giordano, who was one of the main guys at DC, I believe he still is, looked over my stuff, said he was interested, and responded with a, please send more. I gave him a Xerox packet. I had Xeroxes all my work, handed them out right and left. And my friend's going, go to Marvel. Go talk to Marvel. And I was like, I don't know if I want to talk to Marvel. I don't think they'd be interested. And he said, go talk to Marvel. So I walked over there, and a guy by the name of Mark Gruenwald, an editor, looked over my work. He looked up at me, and he said, how would you like to work for Marvel Comics? I fell over.
Liefeld started getting work doing pinups for the actual Marvel Handbook and Who's Who reference titles.
I did some character sketches like they had asked for this book that they were producing for Marvel. So I did send my first, you know, work off, but it wasn't like a story to Marvel. It was some character designs that they had wanted. But DC sent me my first story. The Hawk and Dove book was a 5-issue miniseries, so it was real. It was very finite. You know, it was going to be over in 5 months. And while I was doing that, Marvel then called in. And so I did Spider-Man, and then they moved me into some X-Men books. And eventually there was a book that called The New Mutants that they wanted to change things on, and they moved me into that.
Specifically taking over the New Mutants from Brett Blevins and revamping the team to great success. Liefeld either created or co-created the new team leader, Cable, who is how you imagine Don Connor would be after seeing the original 1984 film, not the losers cast and all the sequels. And also, if he was crossed with a classic T-800 Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator unit, Liefeld also planned to introduce Cougar on the team, and even did a prospective cover featuring him for New Mutants number 87. This image was featured in one issue of Marvel Age magazine, which had previously run a redesign of Cougar. Presumably, since Rob Liefeld had copyrighted Cougar, that plan was aborted. However, Liefeld recycled a near identical shot of Cougar from that unused cover for a splash page in the eventual Youngblood number 1. Before that could happen, though, Liefeld had to turn New Mutants from the dog of the X-Men franchise to a darling, co-create Deadpool, and relaunch the book as X-Force with the top-selling comic of all time.
Your newest comic book, X-Force. How many copies would you say it looks like it's going to sell?
We're, again, very fortunate. It did very well. I think 3.7 million copies, and then there was another 1.5 added on that. It came out above 5 million.
For all of a month or two, at 4 million copies before being eclipsed by the current record holder, X-Men number 1's 8.1 million copies. What experiences have you had with Rob Liefeld? Like, what was the first time you ever experienced him in comics?
First time? You know what? I think probably the first time where I really, like, knew who he was, it had to be because of Youngblood, because I wasn't an X person. So his New Mutants X-Force shit, I had no... Well, you know what? That's not true. It had to be X-Force. I think it had to be seeing his X-Force covers.
So you didn't encounter New Mutants before then?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm picturing, who was the, was it Warpath, the Native American fellow?
Yeah.
I remember him on some covers. I remember always being extremely confused about what the fuck Cable's deal was. But Cable was kind of becoming king shit when I was first getting into comic books. So I would say that's probably the beginning of it.
But you didn't actually read any stories that had Cable in them, huh?
No, never. And see, I was not an X guy, so I didn't collect any of that stuff. But you couldn't miss Cable back then. He was the shit.
Well, that and your brother became an X guy too. Because I mean, how far apart were your guys collecting? Like, did he start collecting after you, or were you collecting at the same time?
We were collecting them at the same time.
And you just basically you had yours and he had his, and the two didn't really meet that much.
Right. Exactly.
You mentioned in the past you weren't really that into Rob Liefeld. Where did you first encounter him?
It must have been a New Mutants cover, if I remember correctly. Let's see. Rob Liefeld was doing Young Mutants and...
Eric Larson
was doing The Hulk, I believe, at the same time. And I was living in California at the time, and I picked up those issues at a 7-Eleven and was reintroduced to Rob.
Wait, what issues? Are you saying you said you saw first saw him on New Mutants covers.
Yeah. Well,
so
that's...
Where
yeah.
were you... Did you see him before any of that stuff? Or was it just you saw him in the covers and then later on you actually read the stories that
The funny thing is I never read those comics. I bought them with the intention of reading them and I've never read them. And then like years later my uncle told me he still had them in his desk. Like he was waiting to give them back to me. But I had bought them and I remember his artwork stood out.
Well, which what? Where in the run was that though? Was that like immediately before X-Force or just?
Yeah, before X-Force. This was all before, because when I lived in Cali it was before Image was created. I think, like I said, it had to be around the time that Eric Larson was drawing the Hulk, because I remember thinking his art style was very distinctive. I just remember looking at Layfield's stuff and thinking, the New Mutants look cool, but they had no feet. Like, I remember thinking...
You even thought back then?
Yeah. Well, because I remember in drawing class when I was in school, and we would draw life characters or life drawings, the teacher always says, feet are the hardest part. Feet and hands are the hardest thing to draw. And it's true, like, to draw... I mean, at least for me, to draw hands or feet are very hard.
I agree, yeah.
And so, after that, in class, which was... He was a really cool teacher because he was always smoking pot. You always could smell it on him. Cool. school hippie art teacher. He kind of planted that in my mind. So anytime I looked at art, comic books, especially comic books, because when I took his class, me and the other dudes were biting comic book art like crazy. You find a cool page and we redraw. I was smart. Them dumbasses were like stealing Marvel comics. I was going to fucking heavy metal. I would find a page I liked and then just basically draw it or a interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was times where if it was a very detailed, I would do just maybe the outside and I'd do some cheats or more shading and try to give it this cool pop art look.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember dudes were doing like straight panels from like the Incredible Hulk, and this other guy was doing panels from Spider-Man but not putting the costume on them. But it was an art class that they just wanted you to learn. And I remember he stuck that in our head, because even those other dudes were like, I remember the one guy was telling me how, yeah, when he drew the feet to the character, he had to literally trace them because he couldn't draw them.
Mm-hmm.
So from that teacher, it always stuck in my head. So even now to this day, when I look at comic books, I always look at their feet and the hands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nowadays, people do a great job on the hands, but the feet, you can still see artists cheating all the time.
Oh, yeah.
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 I don't know why it's so hard to draw feet.
I think just because the way the body flows, you get a kind of a rhythm to the arms and to the legs where that you've got like a certain sweep to it, and you know how it's easier to keep the proportions on the arms and the legs, and then reasonable in the torso as well. But then you've got this hand, and it's this whole complex structure at the end of that, and it has its asymmetry, because that's one of the things too, is the hand, every finger's a different length.
Yeah.
And then you got the thumb, and then they all have to relate to each other in certain ways, and they've got the knuckles and everything else. So it's just a lot trickier, where you don't have the nice smooth line that you do with the muscles of
I used to just draw, cheat and just draw like gauntlets on the end of their hand.
Yeah.
Or it'd be a weapon.
Closed fist.
Yeah, pretty much. I found an old art book of mine, and I had a bunch of sketches I did, and all of them had closed fist or weapons or gauntlets. I was like, holy shit. Like, not one picture are they like leaning against the wall. So I thought it was funny.
What was the first Liefeld comic you actually read?
I think it was a What If. Didn't he do a What If?
He did, I think, a few What Ifs, but the one I always remember is he did What If Wolverine Was an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
S.H.I.E.L.D., yeah.
Where he replaces Nick Fury.
Yeah.
Which is a weird story, because when I read it at the time, and I don't remember when the last time I revisited to see if it still holds, I got the impression that Logan actually set Nick Fury up to die so that he would take over S.H.I.E.L.D. and be able to have a greater hand in how the government related to mutants. I always got this feeling like that Logan actually set him up to get killed by Baron Strucker in that story.
See me?
It's not explicit, but there's a weird implication.
I had this weird thing where I liked collecting the What Ifs. I actually sometimes enjoyed the What Ifs even more than the actual comics.
Oh, sure.
Until they got really goofy, but I think that would be the first one. I remember, I honestly still own that issue. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. I kept all of them that I had because I enjoyed them so
what
much.
Was cool is you could actually be unpredictable with What Ifs, although, especially in the second series, they became predictable because it was always the darkest timeline.
Yeah.
It was always the worst possible scenario. Yeah. That's what we're going to tell you about, but you did have a finite story. They were done in ones at a time period where more and more comic books were getting serialized to the nth degree. So yeah, no, I definitely dug a lot of What Ifs, and I definitely dug them a lot more than a lot of times the stories they were springing off of. That What If that you're talking about, that was actually a combination of Liefeld and Jim Valentino. If I remember correctly, Valentino I don't remember if Valentino inked it or if he did the layouts. I want to say he did the layouts.
But that's that great cover, right, where he's in the S.H.I.E.L.D. uniform.
Yeah, he's got the S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. is behind him, the icon that they used to have.
He's in the uniform itself.
Yeah, he's in the uniform with his punk claws popping. He's got the holster and everything. Yeah, it was cool. Valentino, I think he actually was the pencil artist. I think he laid out the story.
Oh, really?
And then it was Liefeld who came in and did the finishes on it. And then I think they might have had Scott Williams do the inks besides. Oh, so it was actually an early book. Yeah, it was when the storytelling was stronger than Liefeld stuff usually was. So that's why I kind of think that it was Jim Valentino who did the layouts on that
one.
Since you mentioned that, that was probably my first exposure to Liefeld as well, because I did see the covers to the Liefeld books. I remember specifically there was a comic shop in that Dust Bowl flea market, this one really ratty flea market. I think it was off of Telephone Road, where the majority of the flea market was gravel. There were literally trucks parked out on the dirt. But then you had an interior portion that they had like small shops within the flea market itself that were actually behind closed doors where you could lock the door. That was the first time I went to a shop where it actually did have a door, and they had posters up, and it looked like an actual comic shop, but it was inside of a flea market. And I remember I had a choice. And the choice was either to buy one of the early Liefeld New Mutants issues. I think it was specifically the one with Cable versus Sabretooth, where they're like dealing with like the Morlocks, I think, and stuff. I think it was around the time Caliban got all swole and shit. or I could get Ghost Rider number 2. And because I'd always loved Mark Texeira, I went with Ghost Rider number 2 instead. So that was where my path diverged. And I didn't end up looking at any of the Liefeld New Mutant stuff until really toward the end of the run. My brother was picking up Extinction Agenda, because by that point I don't think I was buying any of the X-Files. I think I was just letting him buy it and reading his. And so you had Jim Lee on Uncanny X-Men, although he was a little bit off-brand because he still hadn't found his rhythm on a monthly book yet. So I think he was getting a lot of help, and it was a little rougher looking than his stuff usually was. And then he had John Bogdanov doing X-Factor, and of course that was the dog. It's like, that doesn't look like the cool hip stuff that we're into right now. And then you had Liefeld on New Mutants, but he only did parts of it. I think they had like fill-ins on his issues a lot. I think Terry Schumacher did one of them, for instance. But it wasn't until the last three issues, 98, 99, 100, that's when I really got into it, because that's when they introduced Deadpool and Domino and Gideon, and then they started building toward X-Force, and you got Feral and Shatterstar, and they were just constantly throwing new characters at you, and they're all cool, and they all vaguely remembered stuff that you liked from other things, and a lot of stuff from like outside of comics. They looked like G.I. Joes, or they looked like stuff that you saw in manga, which was still...
I always thought Shatterstar looked weird, though.
He was very, very...
Especially with that headgear.
He looked like something from Japanese comic books, which is part... But, and plus, he had the sword from The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Yeah, the double sword.
Except it didn't fire, but it was still like... No, it was a triple sword, wasn't it? Did he have a double sword or a triple sword? I don't remember.
On the movie?
The movie was a triple sword, right?
Yeah.
Because he would fire the other two blades, and then he would still have like a dagger in the handle of the middle one. Yeah. And then I think Shatterstar had two, because it was always kind of weird.
Yeah.
Although, actually, I watched one of those science videos where they explained that X-23 would actually have more cutting power than Wolverine because of the way the physics work of the distribution of the force behind the blades. Two blades will have a greater force of attack than three blades. Three blades will actually kind of slow you down and blunt the impact of the blades themselves. But two blades are better than one because they have more strength, and how you're distributing where the blades are. You're basically like trapping the thing that you're going after in the middle of these two blades. So you're doing more damage with two than you would with one or with three. So Shatterstar had it right, even though it looked like he was running around with tuning forks.
Okay.
I fucking loved those three issues of New Mutants. I was so fascinated with the world building that was happening there. I'd never liked the New Mutants title. And so to see somebody come in there and do something where it was actually really interesting, and you're fighting all these robots and Gideon's all cool. I was totally down. I was totally game. Me and my brother, I remember being so super hyped, so excited about that book at that point in time. New Mutants ended, and then there was like a hiatus before X-Force started. And I pick up X-Force number 1, and it was a double-sized issue, and it had the trading card, and you know, this is like all the hype around the mutants at that point in time. This is going to be my jam. I was like waiting with bated breath for X-Force to come out. And I bought it, and I read it, and I was like, there's that. You know, just it didn't live up to what I expected from it.
You're cynical at a young age.
Well, and what was funny too is in the time period, I think between New Mutants and X-Force coming out, I moved to Colorado, and I started working an afternoon job. There's a nerdy dude that I knew that was also into comics, didn't have any friends, so I was like the cool nerdy kid to his nerdier nerdy kid. So I got to be the cool kid of that sad dynamic between two whole people. So he got me a job where we were digging the basement of an old man's house. Like he was wanting to try to put a cellar under his house. So we'd crawl under his house and play AC/DC on a tape deck while we half-assed broke up rocks underneath his house and shoveled the rocks out the side of the house and put them in a wheelbarrow and took them over to a big, you know, what a cliff. Lived on like a sort of a hill thing in Colorado. Everything's on like some kind of big hill thing, and it had a great big ditch behind it. So we would just dump the rocks out behind this ditch and then grow back under and listen to more Back in Black. And a lot of the time we were just under the house bullshitting and stuff. And I actually felt bad. I had a stronger work ethic than this kid, and we were making a whole $1.25 an hour, I think, for doing that. And so I would take that money and other money. I did a little babysitting. I did very little yard work, and I would go and I'd invest that money into Rob Liefeld comics at the local comic shop. What was one of my favorite things about living in Colorado was I actually literally walked down the street from a comic shop. I would walk past that comic shop to and from school every day. It was hard for me to resist going in there. I didn't go in there every day. I probably went in there a few times a week, though, just because it was so accessible and because he had quarter bins. So if nothing else, I'd go in there and I'd buy shitty Greater Mercury / Silver Wolf books that were worth nothing, and they were garbage and they were just ultraviolet. But they would often be drawn by Tim Vigil, and it's like, oh, I'm really into this Tim Vigil guy. You know Tim Vigil, right? The guy from Faust?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, so he got to start doing these shitty low-rent books where like covers had type on it. Some dude literally like was typing shit out on on a typewriter and then like pasting it onto the covers to make logos and shit. Garbage, bottom of the basement publishing. And he was still not ready for prime time, and he was doing a character. I can't remember what the name was. He might have been called Silver Wolf or something, but it was clearly like a proto Faust, who himself is basically just like Batman plus Wolverine.
Yeah.
Once again, two claws instead of three claws. So I'd buy those shitty little quarter books, but then with my real money, I'd put together like 16 whole dollars in a row and buy one of those early Rob Liefeld New Mutants. I was heavily invested in those New Mutants. I never had the first Cable. I just had did a second printing with gold ink. Mm-hmm. And so I had that one. And so
I
didn't love those books. I wasn't like, I liked individual issues. I thought it was cool when Cable fought Wolverine. I thought it was cool when Sabretooth showed up. There's a lot of dogs in the midst of that run too. But I still thought that those last three issues were cool. And then X-Force comes out and I'm buying that every month. And at that point, I actually have a pool box. And so I'm getting it as a monthly subscription. And it's like, I was so into Liefeld's art style. I loved his work so much, in part because he was the only one of those hot image artists that I could draw like. I could swipe some serious, like, not so much swiping. I totally could bite his style. I remember, like, I have a bunch of fake comic book covers I drew. I've still got them in a box somewhere. Before, you know, I would write anything down, what I would do is I had my action figures. You'd play with action figures. You'd make stories with your action figures. So I had all these convoluted histories with those characters. And one year, I think it was a Christmas or birthday present, I was actually given a word processor. You remember those?
Yeah.
Okay. For the kids, the word processor is a typewriter that had a computer built into it that could remember like whole pages worth of text. And so you could type everything out on the word processor and then you would print it out as an actual paper. And then you'd exhausted all the memory this thing had, then you had to start on the next page. So I was actually typing out the stories I'd done with the action figures, synopses. I wouldn't write like the whole story. I'd do a synopsis of those adventures I would have with the action figures. And then what I'd do is I'd take the toys and I would draw them in Rob Liefeld style so that I could turn them into the comic books that I was conceiving in my brain, right? And so if I try to do like Jim Lee, I could never do Jim Lee worth a damn. I remember one time I did draw Psylocke nude though, full frontal, and it was a total swipe, and I still really couldn't pull off Jim Lee style even as a swipe. But with Liefeld, I could like have his artwork around and just bite the style without actually full on copying his work, and it looked pretty decent. It looked pretty close to Liefeld, so I got a buzz off of that because he was like the one guy, and he had all these little quirks that he would do, like the way he would do like the lines going down the faces for the shadowing around the eyes, or he'd do those little sperm things, those little like, you know what I'm talking about? The little like bubble things with the teardrop trail to them. And so you could copy those superficial elements, and his anatomy was kind of fucked anyway. So if I fucked the anatomy, it really wasn't that far off from what Liefeld was doing professionally. So I could actually pull it off, and I got really excited about being able to do that. And you look at his pages, they're still very energetic. There's still a lot of energy. You could see his enthusiasm for the art form in the pages he produced for books like X-Force. The stories were pretty much shit though.
Yeah.
They held together okay with Fabian Nicieza's scripts, but it was still like too much action figures bashing up against each other, not actual stories. And what I found is I kept reading X-Force up into like issue 25 or so. And I actually liked the stories a lot better once Liefeld was completely gone. It was at its worst when Liefeld was still plotting, and then they were bringing in artists like Mark Pacella to do real poor man's wannabe Liefeld. But once Liefeld was completely gone, and especially when Greg Capullo came on, that book looked fucking good. I really enjoyed Capullo's artwork. Because he had been doing Quasar, and he kind of a girly looking, you know, he was kind of soft, kind of effeminate looking, not just the character, but also the style. And so when he switched over to X-Force, he brought a much more of a Mike Golden aesthetic it, reminding me a lot of his stuff on books like when he was doing like G.I. Joe covers and stuff.
I thought he was doing NAMM, wasn't he?
He did NAMM covers too, yeah, but he also did some G.I. Joe stuff.
Oh, okay.
Tapped into, again, these guys grew up on the same shit I grew up on, and they liked the same kind of cool shit that I liked when I was younger. And so X-Force suddenly became the book that I always wanted it to be to a large degree. I just had burned out on the X-Men and I finally dropped it after the 2-year point, but that was the only one that I actually had some kind of regret where I was like, well, maybe I'll stick with X-Force. And I finally just like, no, I'm going to commit. And then thankfully Greg Capullo left almost immediately after I did, and it was replaced by Tony Daniel, who I never was very fond of. Even though I had all these issues with X-Force, I was like, well, but I'm buying Youngblood, you know, I this Image thing is so exciting. I'm so interested in seeing what they're going to do with Youngblood. And I remember buying that first issue, and there was even an ad for the Rob Liefeld fan club, the official Rob Liefeld fan club, and I halfway thought about joining. You know, I love Liefeld's art so much, but this comic really wasn't any good at all. This was really kind of bad. So I'll hold on to this book, and I'll see how I like the later issues, and then maybe I'll join the Liefeld fan club. And guess what? I never joined the Liefeld fan club.
Those fans were so crazy about this stuff, and they bring me their X-Force comics and their New Mutants comics, and you see the electricity in their faces, and they are reliving that energy with me at that moment, and it's very exciting. And so it's, you know, when they came out, when they hit the scene, those books were the top of the charts. Mm-hmm. And when comics had the most eyeballs were on these characters because they were at the top of the charts. And so those fans, I meet them, hey, Rob, I'm 36, and I was 15 when I bought your comics, and I want you to meet my son, and he's clutching onto a Deadpool action figure in one hand and a bobblehead in the other. And that's exciting, man. That's tremendously exciting. It just shows you that there's a legacy of these characters that's been passed down. I'm telling you, the culture at Marvel was changing. They didn't like how popular we'd become. The bottom line was the sales were following Todd, Rob, and Jim, and the other guys. I think they thought the gimmicks sold covers. And, you know, I think what happened in 91 has dictated the last 20 years of Marvel Comics and how artists, you don't get to tell us jack anymore. It's a writer-driven TV room concept where we build a corporate strategy and therefore really nobody gets to take a bow. Marvel takes the bow. I tell people all the time, Marvel has turned into a company that wants you to think that you press a button. There's a Marvel button in a room where you go, and a character comes out. Marvel made it.
While preparing to launch X-Force, Liefeld was also planning a creator-owned team book called The Executioners that was advertised in the industry newspaper Comic Buyer's Guide. Editors at Marvel called Liefeld, saying that he would be fired if he produced the book by that name. Angered by being stymied by Marvel and goaded by fellow top artist and mentor Todd McFarlane, Liefeld instead decided to revive Youngblood at Malibu Comics before inciting the full-on Image exodus. By the way, the Youngblood Y emblem on member suits was just an X-Men red X in a circle with one corner removed.
Tell me a little bit about Youngblood. You got real life with it, right?
Youngblood is a team of government superheroes. They, as an answer to like nuclear weapons, they start genetically engineering these super people.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they become celebrities. Because it all started off with, I thought of, there was a guy like Superman. He'd be like the world's biggest celebrity, and he'd be doing like Coca-Cola commercials and Nike endorsements. And so I figured, let's try this. And so that's basically what we're doing with Youngblood.
The term Youngblood was even used for a time as a replacement for superhero in early Image titles. Paralleling his creation, Liefeld became an enormous success, a millionaire before he was 25, appearing on a Levi's 501 commercial directed by Spike Lee and numerous talk shows like Good Morning America. Youngblood number one became the top-selling creator-owned comic of all time for a month or two, before being replaced by current record holder Spawn number one's 1.7 million copies. It had bound-in trading cards and was a flipbook featuring two covers, two stories, and two Youngblood teams. Did the fact that they really looked a lot like the Avengers have anything to do with your appreciation of them?
No, I don't think so. Again, I think it was more that collective consciousness peer pressure thing. That's why I got on.
Well, and my question too is, do you even see the Avengers?
Because really honestly, well, for me, like when I see that dude, what's his name, Bedrock?
Mm-hmm.
I think the Thing. I don't think the Hulk. Mm-hmm. He probably was supposed to be the Hulk, right?
Very Thing-like, actually, in a lot of ways. He was just like Kid Thing because he was supposed to be. You see, when the series was starting, because of how he was written in the first issue, I thought he was supposed to be like 12. But in reading the series, because I've read all 10 issues of the original Youngblood series, it turns out that at least by the latter issues, he's supposed to be 17 years old. But he's really a gee-golly kind of dorky kid, which they make a point of reinforcing too. Apparently, like his dad was a scientist and his life sucked so bad that he basically was going to, I don't know if he was going to suicide himself or if it just was so bad that he was willing to take a risk. So he basically just drinks his dad's experimental formula and that's how he becomes Bedrock. But he's a real geeky kind of kid. So he's kind of like if Captain Marvel were in the Thing's body. You know Captain Marvel, like Shazam?
Okay, I gotcha.
So for a 17-year-old, he talks and acts more like an 8-year-old, aside for being fascinated with the babes. But yeah, that's basically what you've got. It's the Thing with Billy Batson's, not really Billy Batson's brain, but like a Captain Marvel brain, like innocent, boyish kid.
And I really liked, I thought, who was the main guy? Was it Shattershot or some shit like that? Shaft. No, it was Shaft, right?
Sure Shot. No, it was Shaft, yeah.
Shaft. I thought he looked cool. Obviously, bow and arrow. As soon as you see bow and arrow, you think Hawkeye or Green Arrow. But I thought he looked cool with his exposed hair and the weird, remember that thing that they were doing in the 90s where it was like a mask but not a mask?
Yeah, he was basically like the rad headband.
But
it was more than a headband because they would always have the cheek guards and the chin guard and the straps of a helmet without actually wearing the helmet.
No, it's like a sun visor with a chin strap.
I mean, it looked cool in the 90s. It makes no real sense, but
no,
especially
because
their hair was always really wild anyway and flying all over the place. So I don't think it did anything for the visibility.
And then who was the cyborg guy?
I have a feeling that our viewers would probably love to see you create a brand new character in front of their eyes.
Okay, exclusively.
Think you're up to it?
Exclusively on this show. Yeah.
Terrific.
As a matter of fact, the other day, I'm just going to start right now.
How do you start with a new character? What do you think of first? The name?
Yeah, the name. I think the name is really important. Kids don't get excited over, you know, Petunia Man or you know, Milkman. That they want the Hulk. or Cable, or this new name I got for this guy. His name is Die Hard.
Die Hard.
And it sounds deadly. Sounds deadly. You know, I think the kids would like him. So, first of all, you've
got Bruce
standard.
Willis gets after you.
Oh, yeah. He'll be a big fan of this character.
Die Hard. That's right. I thought he looked cool, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a bad design.
And then who was African-American fellow?
Chapel.
Chapel. So didn't Chapel end up doing... Didn't he go on and be one of the more famous characters of this? Or am I just thinking, is the name just ringing?
He had high visibility because he appeared on the Spawn cartoon. And
that's what it was. Holy shit. That's what it is, right?
And he got action figures. And he was in the Youngblood Strike File anthology series where it was like him. And I think it was usually Die Hard. And it was a flip book. And he'd star on one side, Die Hard on the other side. So
very interesting stuff.
And you pretty much exclusively mentioned the home team. Because remember, there were two teams in the book, right?
I do not.
Wait.
Yeah. There was the, holy shit. It's like semi coming back to me, but semi not.
Well, if you bought Youngblood number one, the first side was the home team. And that was the guys who did more superhero-y stuff. The guys who seemed to be more about media consciousness and such. And then there was the away team, and they did the international missions. They were the CIA to the home team's FBI. And in the first issue, they go after basically Saddam Hussein and kill Saddam Hussein.
Oh, no shit.
You don't remember that at all?
I do not remember that at all. Wow.
Yeah, and so there's a whole other team of guys, and you didn't mention a single one of them, so it shows what an impression they made on you. Because basically, I think the only one you missed from the home team was Vogue.
Oh, she was girl.
Yeah, she was girl.
But wasn't there was other, I'm looking at the cover now.
And you did say green hair person. Maybe you're thinking of the purple haired girl, because that's who she was.
No. No, that's not who I'm thinking of.
Okay, she was the mime with the purple hair and the eye points. Like
she's
she
not
had
Domino.
Makeup with pointy eye thingies.
Not Domino.
Yeah, a little bit of Domino, but her backstory is basically Black Widow.
Well, I said not Domino, but also kind of Domino. But who's this other guy? I'm looking at the cover number one, the guy behind Die Hard with the beard.
I am not looking at the cover, so give me a moment.
Well, who's prepared for this podcast? You know, guy with the beard behind other guy.
Okay, I thought that's who it was when you mentioned him. That's Combat, and even though he's on the cover...
Is that with a K? Wait, is that Combat with a K?
I believe it actually is just plain old Combat for a change.
Oh, goddamn.
Although he is an alien, and his alien version of his name is like Combat with a K, like H-M apostrophe B-T or something like that. So you're like half right.
But yeah, you're right.
Combat is Worf.
Oh, for real? Okay,
yeah.
I got that.
Yeah, totally. But he's actually not a member of the home team. He's part of the away team.
Let me see if I'm thinking of who I'm thinking of. No, that's not who I'm thinking of. I'm going through the fucking roster of people here. Who the hell is this green-haired fellow that I was thinking of? He's on the cover, because you said it was the back cover, right? Is the other team?
Yeah, the away team has no green-haired people. Are you talking about the dude who's got green energy hair? Is that what you're talking about? Like green?
Well,
he has green energy coming out?
Come on, dude. Yes, that's who I'm talking about.
It's not hair, though. It's energy. He's got Firestorm's fire hair, but it's green and yellow fire. And that's Photon. And he's also an alien, and he's from an alien race that has some sort of a weird relationship with the alien race that Combat's part of. And apparently there's a subplot that pops up in I think like the sixth issue of the ongoing series that never gets mentioned again over the course of the entire first volume, where Combat is regarded as a suspected traitor to his race, and then this Photon dude is like a lieutenant from another race, and they left to go to Earth together. And so they're both wanted by the authorities from their respective alien races who are working together to track them down on Earth.
No shit.
Yeah. And he's all shimmery. He's kind of like Frankie Ray from Heralds of Galactus. He looks like a Herald of Galactus.
Hey, let me tell you something. The fact that you're fucking arguing over the semantics to me, whether or not that's not green hair or green energy hair, is really fucking bothering me, and I'm not so sure I can let it go.
Well, you're saying hair.
Of course I'm talking about the glowing green fucking hair. Well,
Because it's not hair, so I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking of hair, and I can't, and though, like, Photon, I mean, not Photon, Vogue was the one who had the funky hair, so I kept trying to think, it wasn't Photon, and then I had to go, I mean, it wasn't Vogue, and so I had to actually go look at the cover to see what the fuck you were talking about. Unfortunately, we spent so much time talking about Rob Liefeld and his characters that we can't actually discuss any of the stories they appear in. So folks will have to tune in 1 month for the next episode of The Spawnometer.
This is bullshit.
Earth is invaded by an alien alliance composed of several species, including the Dominators, the Kuns, the Denegarians, and the Durlans. And they want our superheroes. Even though Australia has been decimated, the United Nations response is unequivocal. Drop dead. First Strike, the Invasion Podcast, takes you back to that moment in time and covers the entire Invasion DC Comics crossover. Issue by issue, tie-in by tie-in, join Bass and Siskoid at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on iTunes. First Strike, the Invasion Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Remember, Albert.
Hi, I'm Jay Editon.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we're the hosts of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, a weekly podcast all about the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
Check out our podcast. New episodes go up on Thursdays at Comics Alliance and on iTunes, Stitcher.
If you like this or our podcast, give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you'd like, feel free to contribute to our Patreon.
Thanks for listening or watching or whatever you're doing.
We'll see you next week.
This has been a Roll Spine podcast. Spawn and all related characters and concepts are the copyright of Todd McFarlane. If you've got something to say, tell it to our email or webpage or feed locations. We may even read them one of these days. If you're in a rush, you can hit up Diablo Frank on his Twitter feed. I, Mr. Fix-It, don't tweet.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended. Any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!